And our next case for this morning is Harper v. Cook County, case number 083413. Ms. Hannon.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Maureen Hannon. I'm an assistant state's attorney appearing on behalf of the sheriff and the county of Cook in this matter. We are here appealing the decision of the district court certifying an undefined class without a clear injury and with claims and issues that continue to be a moving target. That error alone was not in compliance with Rule 23C that requires the class actions be clearly defined in the issues set forth in the order.
Is that a jurisdictional problem or simply an error?
Just an error, Your Honor. In addition, it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to find that the four requirements set forth in Rule 23A were met. But most importantly, and the reason that we filed this interlocutory appeal, is that the class as set forth by Robert Harper can never meet the predominance and the superiority requirements set forth in Rule 23B3.
Can we reach the merits of that in light of the court's error in failing to define the class?
Yes, we can, Your Honor, because the errors that are inherent and the lack of definition still will not help the fact that the Fourth Amendment test for whether the delay was reasonable under the circumstances has been held to need to be done on a case-by-case basis. That is this circuit's decision in Lewis versus O'Grady and also in Chortek versus Milwaukee. The class that Harper seeks to represent are pretrial detainees who have already had their preliminary hearing before a judge. I mean, their probable cause hearing before the judge. The judge has remanded these individuals to the sheriff's custody. In appropriate cases, the judge orders that bond may be set in a certain amount. When the bond is posted, who posts it for the detainee, and all the variables attendant to the posting of bond have nothing to do with the sheriff's office. He has no control over that. In order for an individual to become a class member of Harper's proposed class and the class certified by this district court, they would have to first establish that there was someone ready, willing, and able to post bond, and they did comply with the requirements of that contract between the clerk and the detainee, or the individual who acts as surety for them. That issue alone would make the hearing for each member be done on a case-by-case basis. The sheriff would then have an opportunity to assess and to support the fact that the delay for each detainee was not unreasonable under the circumstances. Those factors alone make this not manageable for class adjudication. But the second prong of that requirement under Rule 23B is that this be a superior method of adjudication. And the existence of this in this circuit of two class actions already addressing two prongs of the processing requirement makes this issue not a superior method of adjudication. And I speak of Jackson versus Cook County, which is a class action brought challenging the STD test that was given to pretrial detainees and prisoners during the same window of time. The attorney in the Jackson case is the same attorney before you now. With the settlement agreement in the Jackson case, over, I think, 1,800 prisoners and pretrial detainees agreed to a settlement through their lawyer where they each got $200 cash. Though that would be a bigger class of the one that Harper opted out. Harper had a chance and was a member of the Jackson case. He opted out and wants to bring his own case for damages. This would not be manageable for Harper because the majority, if not all of the class members, would already have recovered $200 under the Jackson case.
It's my understanding that in his deposition, when questioned about the nature of his claim here, he testified that he really was only objecting to two aspects of the screening process, the intake screening process, that being the STD test, which is covered by that class action that's already been settled, and the other aspect is the strip search.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. He had no problem with the blood test or the X-ray, which were the other problems. I mean, the other prongs of the processing.
And that's so his claims have been comprehensively covered in the other class actions, it seems to me, based on that testimony, so I'm not sure what's left.
And we did argue that, Your Honor, that plaintiff failed to meet the numerosity requirement just for that reason alone, there isn't anybody who would be in his class besides Robert Harper. He would still have the delay of damages claim, Your Honor, but again, that is a requirement that needs to be done on a case-by-case basis, analyzing how long the delay was and whether the delay was unreasonable on behalf of the Sheriff's Office at that day and that time. The other existing class action is the Young case, Young versus Cook County Sheriffs. That case is not in settlement, but partial summary judgment has been awarded to the plaintiffs in that case. It addressed the strip search procedure that is currently done for the same group of detainees that would also be member of Harper's class. Harper has opted out of the Young case as well. So again, there's nothing left for Harper to represent with respect to those people. The numerosity claim was not met pursuant to the issues of fact and the problems we've just discussed with the Young and the Jackson case. It was also an error for the court to find that commonality was met. The district court relied on what I would call non-material issues of fact. For example, he found that a common issue among the detainees would be whether they were assigned a CIMIS number for processing. That is not a material issue that would further advance the litigation, and it was an error for the court to rely on that as a common issue of fact. They do all get a CIMIS number. Once they are remanded to the sheriff's custody, yes, they do get a number, but that does not mean that their constitutional rights were infringed in any way. Nor can plaintiff meet the typicality requirements. The liability for each member and for the sheriff's office would be different, as we've discussed, on a case-by-case basis. The damages would also be different for each detainee. It's apparent from the sworn declarations that were attached to the plaintiff's reply brief that the individuals were detained for different amounts of time. They vary anywhere from 5 hours to 14 hours. That variation would make this class not suitable for adjudication as a group.
Finally, was the cognizability of that claim tested in the motion to dismiss, or was that one of the new iterations of the claim that only came out later?
We tried to argue that, Your Honor, in response to the original motion to dismiss. There wasn't anything new with respect to the typicality that the plaintiff raised.
I mean, was it clear that he was challenging the delay when the motion to dismiss was litigated, that was actually part of the claim? Or?
Yes, it was, Your Honor, and the motion to dismiss, unfortunately, was denied. But the delay has always been the bigger factor. It's the delay alone that he's challenging, as we know, this circuit has ruled in Lewis versus O'Grady that the delay has to be done on a case-by-case basis because the sheriff's office needs flexibility in administering its jail and keeping security as the utmost concern, while at the same time processing approximately 300 detainees a day into its facility. It was an error for the district court to certify the class without giving us additional discovery. There were 15 sworn declarations that the plaintiff attached to his reply brief. We filed a motion after receiving those sworn declaration seeking to depose at least a limited number of the declarants. It was an error for the district court to not give us that opportunity. We could have better flushed out for the court the flaws in the certification and the fact that the requirements under 23A were not met. But as I said, that motion alone would not have cured the problems.
But it's my understanding that from the face of the declarations themselves, it was clear that some of these people, perhaps most, are not even members of the class or were compensated in the other class action.
That's exactly it, Your Honor. They would have recovered under Jackson, certainly, and as undergoing the strip search policy, they would fall right within the Young case as well. If the court has no further question, I'll reserve my other time remaining for rebuttal. We will be asking for the court to vacate the decision below and remand solely for the issues on Robert Harper's claim. Thank you.
Mr. Flaxman.
May it please the court. The court doesn't have jurisdiction to this appeal. This isn't about an error by the district judge not defining the class. This is about a party acting too soon. It was premature for the defendants to come to this court and ask for permission to appeal. The time to do that was after the district judge entered his order defining the class.
Well, the judge purported to enter an order certifying a class. He just did it incorrectly. Why is it that not just a garden variety error instead of a jurisdictional bar?
That isn't what he did. His order said, I'm certifying the class and give me a class definition within 10 days. It wasn't until that class definition was approved by the judge that there would be the order contemplated by Rule 23F defining the class.
He granted the motion to certify a class. He said the class definition is too broad, narrow it down, and you didn't.
It's like an order granting summary judgment, which leaves for later proceedings how much money somebody gets. It's not a final order.
It's not analogous to that. Rule 23F permits appeal from orders certifying a class. That is what this purports to be. The fact that it is incorrect or flawed under the statute doesn't inhibit jurisdiction. It's just a mistake.
It would have been the order contemplated by Rule 23F if the defendants had waited and let the district judge enter the order saying this is the class.
But if they wait and they wait too long, won't you claim they've waived forfeited their right to appeal the certification?
This court said if you file a motion to reconsider within 10 days of an order certifying a class, even if you have, that tolls the 10 days in which you can seek permission to appeal. And they could have done that rather than filing the notice of appeal. And they had other issues to go back to the district judge. What they should have done, if they're serious about their complaint about being denied discovery, was to come back within 10 days and say, Judge, you denied us discovery. These are the 8 things we would have learned if we had been allowed to take discovery, and you should let us do that. And district judge would have let them do that. But they didn't do that. They just come to this court and say, there are these terrible errors, and they seek to mislead the court, with all due respect, about the other 2 cases, about the swab case and about the strip search case. This case has never been about swabbing or strip searching. This case has been about the sheriff's policy that before he will obey the judge's order allowing somebody to post bond and be released, he takes them into the jail, holds them, and processes them.
If that's true, it's news to your client, because he testified that the only things he objected to were the STD test and the strip search, and those matters were comprehensively covered in the other 2 class actions. And this strikes me as one of the most opportunistic class actions that I have seen.
That's certainly the way the defendants seek to paint it. It is absolutely not an opportunistic class.
Of course it is.
No, it's not, Judge. Every day the sheriff takes people, about 10% of the people who come in and says, who are ready to post bond, and says, you can't post bond until you come back in here, stay in this animal cage, and get processed into the jail. That lets the sheriff go to the county board and say, hey, every year we process in 100,000 people, even if 10% of those get released the same day. In other counties, what happens is the judge sets bond in the courtroom, and if the person has bond money with him or somebody waiting there, they let the sheriff and the court lets that person stay in the courtroom to let that person post bond, to let the family members post bond.
Nothing in the law that says that procedure is constitutionally required.
The question that we're trying to litigate in this case is whether the sheriff's policy, which says you can't post bond until I process you into the jail, is constitutional, whether that complies with the Fourth Amendment. That's what the merits of this case are about. That's not what class certification is about.
Yes, but every individual defendant's length of delay is different, and so it's a very case-specific inquiry.
It's not. The case on which the defendants rely, that Lewis versus O'Grady case, has been overruled, if you will, by the United States Supreme Court in Mueller versus Mena, 544 U.S. 93, which said it's not a question of reasonableness for the jury to decide whether there's probable cause. That's an ultimate legal question. And we believe that when we have a full record and we show that everybody's kept for at least 6 hours after the judge says you can post bond while somebody's trying to post bond, that the district judge in this court would say that is unreasonable. There's no reason to give these people a number, no reason to hold these people. They're ready to post bond. They're ready to go out. They have the right to post bond. They're ready to post bond. Why does the sheriff want to give them a number? Why does the sheriff want to put them in the computer? The sheriff has an express policy which says you can't post bond until you get a CMS number. And then part of the policy says, well, and we'll try the best we can to speed up processing for people when they finally do post bond. And we've submitted affidavits from people who were disclosed way before the discovery was closed on class issue to the defendant saying that I was ready to post bond. I had money with me, and they wouldn't let me post it. There were people waiting out there to post money for me, and they wouldn't let me post it. The ultimate question of constitutional reasonableness is, why is, this policy reasonable? And it's not about swabbing. It's not about strip searching. It's not about whether a plaintiff who's asked questions at a deposition could waive, could define the legal contentions which are being advanced on his behalf. He was asked, do you have trouble with that? Did that bother you? Did this bother you? He wasn't asked, did the fact that you were locked up in the animal cage while your wife was out there with the money to post bond, did that bother you? And that's what bothered him. That's why this case was filed. This isn't opportunistic. If we could do a B2 class and get injunctive relief and not get B3 damages, we would have done that. But we don't have standing unless he's locked up at the time that we filed the lawsuit. This would be a wonderful case. This policy should be changed. The only way it could be changed is not through an opportunistic lawsuit, but to a lawsuit that's done to change what we sincerely believe is an unconstitutional policy that bothers a lot of people who are pretrial detainees, who are presumed innocent. Many of them are innocent. Many of them are dismissed when they finally go to court. There are people out there waiting to post bond for them, and they're not allowed to post bond. But if the sheriff says, my policy, which has been in effect since 1987, according to that written policy, is that we must give everyone a CMS number before they can do what the judge said they wanted to do and post bond. That's what this case is about. The fact that Mr. Harper said, it didn't bother me when they took blood, doesn't mean that's not an issue. That he wasn't asked what he's concerned about. And the proper way to find out what plaintiff's legal contentions are generally is not to ask the plaintiff in a deposition, well, what bothers you about what happened? It's to ask the lawyer and the plaintiff in a contention interrogatory, which could be binding on the plaintiff in the class. What are your legal theories? Why do you believe this was wrong? Why do you contend this was wrong? It's not to ask somebody questions in deposition, but to synthesize, well, it doesn't bother him. The way that this should work, the way that bonds should be posted, is the way it works in other counties outside of Cook County, where you're in the courtroom, bond is set. If you have bond money with you or if somebody's coming to post bond for you, they can post bond. You don't have to be fingerprinted and photographed and given a number and added to the sheriff's statistics so that when he goes to seek money from the county, he can say, I had 100,000 people instead of 90,000 people. Once a judge sets bond, you should be allowed to post bond and leave. The Lewis versus O'Grady case, in addition to being overruled by the Supreme Court case, involved processing people after they'd been to court and the judge said, you're released. The district judge initially said there can be a class action because he believed there was a uniform policy that everybody who is released by the judge has to be sent back to the sheriff. The district judge later learned that that wasn't the uniform policy. It was done on a case-by-case basis and decertified the class. This court held in an unpublished order that's referred to in the published Brady decision that we don't have jurisdiction to review that. We're not going to review whether or not there can be a class. There was never a determination of whether there is a case-by-case basis or there was a uniform basis. But here, we don't have people who've been in custody where warrants might have come up. We have people who have been arrested, who have been fingerprinted by the arresting authority, who have been photographed by the arresting authority, where the arresting authority has checked for outstanding warrants and brought them to a judge for a prompt determination of probable cause and for the setting of bond. This isn't like Lewis versus O'Grady. This is different. This is a uniform policy about setting a bond for pretrial detainees. This is not about, it's not about swabbing. It's not about strip searching. It's about holding people for no reason, just because we want to give them a number or we want to process them in so we could show that we have 100,000 people instead of 90,000 people every year. It's wrong, it's incorrect to say that no, Mr. Harper doesn't represent anyone other than himself. He represents a large number of people who are aggrieved by having been held when they should have been released. And this is not an opportunistic case. This is a case that was brought in good faith to change a policy that we sincerely believe is unconstitutional, that's been in effect for more than 20 years and has never been challenged and should be challenged and should be subject to judicial review, and we believe should be stricken down and not allowed to continue. Thank you.
Ms. Hannon, you have 6 minutes in rebuttal.
First, I'd like to remind the court that Cook County is the largest jail facility in Illinois, and it is the second biggest county in the nation, so second only to L.A. The number of detainees that we are processing is bigger than anybody else. In another county, it is most likely going to be faster for processing.
And not just bigger by a little bit, bigger by a real big bunch.
Yes, Your Honor, that's significantly bigger.
More people going through the courtrooms, more being let out on bond by a whole bunch.
And just more people all around. So we can't do an individual assessment as quickly as someone in another county.
How many are processed daily?
300 is the average number of new detainees. That has nothing to do with all the other current prisoners that have court appearances that day. 300 new people come into the jail every day.
And the purpose of assigning this internal number in the computer is what?
Is to keep, for the sheriff to keep a record of each individual that has just been remanded to his custody for the sheriff. And I want to point out that the order from the criminal court is not you may be released as soon as you post bond. It is there is enough to hold you for your criminal trial. The state has presented probable cause for your arrest and you are remanded to their custody pending trial.
The case is so big that sometimes people get lost in there, don't they?
That's true, but I will point out that the sworn declarations attached, the length of time for the longest one was 14 hours. The sheriff cannot be required to take somebody's word on it that, hey, my Aunt Millie is coming to bond me out in 3 hours. Don't send me down to the processing. That's too much of a responsibility for the sheriff to take the word of the detainee or somebody else that they have enough money. In this economy, even with the credit cards, maybe their credit cards are maxed out and paying the $2,000, which would be the 10% of the $200,000 bond, is difficult. Maybe they have to leave and go to an ATM. The sheriff simply has to wait until...
Might also add that it might be possible the sheriff didn't trust the people who were being submitted.
It's certainly very possible.
A shock.
But he can't take their word for it, and he has to wait until the clerk actually makes the phone call down to the sheriff's office.
The solution is to give him a better class of prisoners, but I don't say it's available to you.
So the sheriff continues to process until the clerk makes the phone call that says this person has, in fact, bonded out. And at that point, their processing is speeded up, and they attempt to get that individual out as quickly as possible. It's important to also point out that plaintiff claims we could have done this in some other way. We brought a motion before the district court when this reply brief was filed with these sworn declarations attached, asking for additional discovery, and that motion was denied. We would have lost our opportunity to appeal to you if we had not filed this motion within the 14 days. And I want to remind the court that plaintiff had 14 days to file his amended definition and didn't do it. So we filed the appeal on the same day he was supposed to file his amended declaration. In addition, he could have filed his amended declaration at any time.
And the request to file a surreply was
denied, and to take a limited number of depositions, and the district court denied that request.
So to ask for reconsideration on the same basis would have been an exercise in futility.
Yes, Your Honor. In this instance, the plaintiff is only asking for damages. This is not a claim for injunctive relief. He has not met the...
Is there a claim for injunctive relief?
Pardon me?
There isn't a claim for injunctive
relief. There is no claim for injunctive relief. It is purely damages for individuals whose bond has been delayed and who aren't able to post. It's a very important thorough check that the sheriff does. Besides assigning the number, which is the first process, that doesn't take very long, they also check for outstanding warrants. And it wouldn't be sufficient or safe for the sheriff's office to let the individual go if they've paid the money right there standing next to the judge. They have to do this thorough check. They are charged with the sheriff is charged with the responsibility of making sure that the individual doesn't have any outstanding warrants and that they are releasing the proper individual. All those factors take time. And in this instance, the sheriff is doing it on a reasonable basis on a case by, and a challenge to that delay would have to be done on a case-by-case basis. We ask you to vacate the order of the district court below and remand this case for the final resolution of Plaintiff Harper's individual claims.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The case is taken under advisement.